Case number 14-5013, Electronic Privacy Information Center versus United States Department of Homeland Security, appellant. Mr. Jed for the appellant, Mr. Rottenberg for the appellee.
Is it freezing in here? Good morning.
Good morning, Your Honors. Adam Jed for the government. May it please the court. At issue here is a procedure that's used by federal and state law enforcement officials who believe that there's some critical emergency, such as a bomb that can be activated by a cellular telephone, in order to weigh the harms and the benefits of turning off that cellular network against, for example, people not being able to access the 911 system using their cellular calls.
Can I ask a question? Is there any reason the government didn't provide the court with a copy of the procedure?
The district court did not initially request a copy of it, and so it was not presented to the court in camera. Obviously, as the court is aware, FOIA generally envisions that these things can be done by declarations, and I don't think the plaintiffs here have argued that
Let me say what I'm concerned about, since it's your burden. Mr. Hauer's declaration, I read it, and it talks about events such as, all right, it doesn't say limited exclusively to. So the such as says to me, well, what else is covered? All right, and it's just odd. He doesn't tell me that he personally has read this, and he doesn't tell me with whom he's spoken that has told him what this document says. And I thought, well, what does it say? I mean, does it say, yes, the type of emergency you're talking about, but does it also drift off into other things as well? Isn't that relevant here?
Well, let me address Your Honor's question in a couple of ways. The first is, I mean, that declaration kind of describes the contents of SOP 303. So I think it is clear from the context that at least the declarant had read SOP 303 and was not just, kind of generally pontificating on what may or may not be in the procedure.
I'll give him that. But he says such as.
Sure. So, I want to make sure that we're not misrepresenting anything to the court. As the declaration says, it would be used in critical emergencies, and the classic example, and indeed the example that this was created to respond to, and the declaration says that too, is cellular-activated bombs. Mm-hmm. I'm aware from speaking to DHS, I've been told, and by the way, the declaration...
Let's not go outside the record here.
Okay. I apologize, Your Honor. The procedure itself, as the declaration and the record spells out, gives a series of steps that can be used to weigh the benefits of turning off the cellular network to stopping that kind of emergency against those various harms. Now, in some kind of a different scenario than a cellular-activated bomb, obviously, if someone has a procedure in their filing cabinet, in theory, they could pull that procedure out. But when they then go to weigh the harms and the benefits, obviously, the benefits of turning off a cellular network are very different if you have the threat of a cellular-activated bomb than if you have, some other kind of scenario that somebody might imagine could come up.
And that's my question.
Your Honor, I want to make sure that I'm understanding Your Honor's question.
The declaration says such as, and you give me the extreme case, but it could be a lot broader.
Well, Your Honor, the purpose of this is to address the extreme case. And remember that this is just a decision-making rubric. So
where
if you used
it... Where does it say extreme case?
I'm sorry, Your Honor?
Where does it say extreme
case? I was just picking up on Your Honor's language.
That's my point.
The language in the declaration is...
It says such as...
The language in the declaration is critical emergencies, such as. So when I hear critical emergency, I think that connotes an extreme case. A kind of run-of-the-mill case would not be a critical emergency, and that is the language.
Well, it depends how you define emergency.
Well, it does say critical emergency, but, Your Honor, I mean, I don't want to fight Your Honor's question.
No, I'm just trying to understand whether we're just supposed to rubber stamp the declaration.
Let me offer three responses to that question, Your Honor.
Right.
First, as FOIA generally operates, this is done by declaration.
No problem there. And we often send it back for more details.
Sure. Second, the plaintiffs here, although they've suggested that there may be a segregability problem, have not said that what is in the declaration is different from what is actually in the procedure or requested in-camera review.
Have they seen the procedure?
Yeah.
They have not, but they have not even suggested.
So did they
even ask for in-camera review?
They have not asked for in-camera review other than
and
perhaps
we have held, I think, repeatedly that in-camera review is not necessary.
Yes, that's it. That's exactly correct, Judge Santel. But, Judge Rogers, I mean, you know, I don't want to push back on you too much. If the plaintiffs had raised that and if the court thought that it was necessary, obviously that could, in theory, be produced. It might, in this situation, better be produced to the district court, which had just said that ENF are wholly inapplicable.
I mean,
under
normally
the
there's a little footnote in the government brief that says if the court wishes to see this document, government is prepared to make it available. There's no such footnote here.
I apologize for that, Your Honor. I think that's just because the plaintiffs did not ask for that. But had they asked for it and were it necessary, the government would make it available, presumably to the district court, applying the correct standards under 7F and 7E.
All I'm getting at is that you may be totally correct on your legal points, but do we say you're correct and we have no idea what's in the document?
Well, the reason, Your Honor, is our legal points, the arguments that we're making before this court, concern the interpretation of 7F and 7E.
Yes.
And the plaintiffs are making arguments about the interpretation of
7F
and 7E.
That's right. So you have to show us that this document fits within 7E or 7F.
Yeah.
Well,
and how do we know is all I'm getting.
Sure. And for the purposes of this appeal, Your Honor, all that we're saying is that the district court simply relied on an incorrect legal construction
legal standard,
of 7F and 7E.
Right.
No.
The plaintiffs have not, as an alternate ground, said, well, even if the government's construction is correct, nonetheless, you've got to look at this thing in
you,
camera.
You would not assert, would you, that your 7E argument is as strong as your 7F argument?
I think our 7F argument is far simpler and more straightforward. Obviously, 7F says that this is meant to protect the life and physical safety of any individual. Here, the release of this procedure, whether it is, by the way, Judge Rogers, just used to stop a bomb or used to stop other, in the language of the declaration, critical emergencies, is still something that would stop the danger to any individual and, indeed, to many individuals, Judge Santel.
So, looking at the plain language, there's nothing that would say that the gloss that the Second Circuit put on it would survive review by the Supreme Court?
That's absolutely our view. The government filed a cert petition after the Second Circuit's decision in light of an intervening law that was passed by Congress. The Second Circuit's decision was vacated. As the court is aware, we have made an alternate argument that even applying the Second Circuit standard, as this court did in Peer, that nonetheless these documents...
Now, wait. What do you say the court did in Peer?
Well, obviously, this court is ultimately the best interpreter of its own decisions, but it would have...
You didn't just concede that we applied the Second Circuit standard, did you?
Well, Your Honor, in Peer, it appears that what the court said is
in Peer,
that...
we said even if we agreed.
Yes, that's absolutely correct. I apologize if I misspoke. Okay. The court did not say the Second Circuit standard was correct. It just said even if that were correct, applying that standard nonetheless... kind of broadly describing
contrary to the very misleading way in which your opposing counsel cites that language out of context, it followed the phrase, even if we agree.
Right.
I will let my opposing counsel characterize his own brief.
He'll have to tell us about that, of course.
And Judge Rogers, in addition to the fact that we just think the plain text of 7F refers to any individual, this can also just be inferred from the history and the context of 7F. I mean, it seems that the plaintiffs themselves agree that in 1986, when the language was changed from law enforcement personnel to any individual, that Congress was not trying to add any extra restriction. They were just broadening the category of persons
that
who would be covered.
The phrase of any individual is just pure surplusage.
Yeah.
If Congress had written the statute and said it endangers life or physical safety, period, we would read that. They weren't talking about animals or dogs or cats. They were talking about people.
Well, I think they're...
And in fact, I noticed when I was rereading Peer that Judge Kavanaugh at one point said the inundation maps, if disclosed, could reasonably be expected to endanger life or physical safety.
Exactly.
Period. Yeah. I don't see that any individual adds anything to the statute.
Well, I think probably the real reason that Congress wrote it that way is just because they were modifying the pre-1986 version of the statute. So you had a statute which referred to the life and safety of law enforcement personnel. They debated sort of how to expand the scope of law enforcement personnel. Some had discussed maybe just having it cover people in the law enforcement sphere, like families of law enforcement personnel, something like that. And the decision that they ended up landing on was that this should protect anyone. And I think that's probably why Congress wrote it this way. Judge Randolph, it does seem that if it just said life or physical safety, you're probably right that in context, no one would think that that applied to animals or property. But someone could come here and make the argument and say, look, physical safety includes physical safety of property or the life of animals. So perhaps Congress could have written this more clearly, although to be fair, I do think that the way that Congress wrote it provides a certain degree of clarity that might actually be lacking in the alternate way to write this.
I don't know why you would want to go into the legislative history, because what's there...
We're more than happy to rest on the plain text, Your Honor.
There are many different sort of statements there that could suggest a very different view the amendments.
As we discussed in our brief, I think actually even the legislative history that the plaintiffs refer to does not support the rule.
You're familiar with Judge Leventhal's description of the legislative history?
I'm not sure that I'm familiar with that particular one.
It's like going to a party and looking over the crowd and picking at your friends.
Yes, Your Honor. I've heard versions of that. Well, we're more than happy just to rely on the plain text, which says the life or safety of any individual, and here any and indeed many individuals are in danger. Although I would certainly be happy to discuss the 7E argument if the court is interested, I would otherwise save my remaining time for rebuttal.
Good. All right. Thank you.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Counsel for Appley.
Thank you and good morning. My name is Mark Rotenberg for EPIC. The FOIA request that gives rise to this matter before the court was submitted to the government after there was a disruption of cell phone service at subway stations in San Francisco.
Is that actually germane to the issue before us?
Well, we believe it is, Judge Sentel.
Wouldn't the law be the same whether there had ever been a disruption in San Francisco or not?
We think it speaks to the underlying purpose of the Freedom of Information Act, which is, of course, to inform the public about the activities of government. And the activities of government concerning the disruption of cell phone service impacts virtually everybody in the country today, which even the Chief Justice noted in his opinion concerning cell phone searches this term. Also, as Judge Rogers in her question at the outset suggests, the fact that this procedure can be used in circumstances that do not simply involve the possible remote detonation of a bomb, but also the disruption of a communications network underscores the public interest in the disclosure of the relevant government policy. And it was not just, by the way, the incident in San Francisco that gave rise to the request. There was at the same time an FCC proceeding on the circumstances to disrupt cell phones.
So that is my question. If there had been no such incident in San Francisco, the law would be exactly the same, right? You're here on a matter
yes.
of law.
Yes. Well, as to the interpretation of 7E and 7F, we're happy to argue that Judge Boasberg found correctly that the government had not sustained its burden in asserting those exemptions. But as to the broader purpose of the statute, which we think also must be considered in assessing the scope of the exemptions, which the court spoke to in Milner, those exemptions are to be narrowly construed precisely because the purpose of the statute.
But on the other hand, the law is settled and has been for years that why you want the document and what you want to do with it is totally irrelevant to the question whether you're entitled to it.
Yeah. We would agree with that, Judge Randolph, but at the same time, the nature of the dispute here also speaks to the adequacy of the Holzer Declaration. There are two brief paragraphs in that declaration in support of the government's case that 7E and 7F are properly asserted here. The government in its briefing continually talks about the remote detonation of a bomb.
Do you agree that that is that dealing with that possibility, such as happened in Madrid, is a function of the SOP?
We certainly believe it provides a basis for government action in this area. There's no dispute as to that point.
In order to prevent that sort of terrorist attack. But you say that, well, it can be used for other things. But once it's disclosed, then its capability of preventing the terrorist attack is diminished.
Well, that's the critical...
Does that mean that 7F clearly applies?
We don't believe so. That is the dispute concerning the scope of 7F. And again, we agree with Judge Boasberg in the Second Circuit opinion. We didn't mean to suggest, Judge Sentel, that you relied or adopted the Second.
You read your brief, didn't you?
I don't believe we did.
Page 17 tells us this court held in Peer, that individuals, quote, living downstream of a dam, close quote, constitute a, quote, described population, close quote, thus allowing the government to identify, quote, with reasonable certainty, close quote, a particularized threat to a discrete population. Excuse me, one more set of quotes in there. Sats appears, then it says, citing ACLU, the Second Circuit case, without saying that it cited it in the sense of saying even if we agreed with it, which would seem to suggest we probably didn't.
Yes, but Judge Santel, actually the phrase we were drawing attention to at that point in the brief was circumscribed population.
Exactly, and you seem to be suggesting there that we were following the Second Circuit on that point.
Well, what we were attempting to do there was, as in the Second Circuit opinion, in your own opinion and Peter, it was significant that the government was able to establish through the declaration a circumscribed population, which is to say the downstream population
Nothing in Peer suggests that they had to do that. Peer expressly was saying that if we agreed with it, they would meet it. It's not saying we agreed with it.
But let me ask you, to the extent that you cited Peer for the reason you say you cited it, why isn't that applicable here as well?
I'm not sure if I understand the question.
Well, in other words, if the government is concerned about a possible threat to the San Francisco subway or something like that, people who are on the subway, people who live near the subway, I mean, those people are a discrete population, as it were.
Well, I
think that... know name and address, but...
I think that takes us back to the central question, which is what meaning to give the phrase any individual in 7F. And we think, of course, the words need to be given some meaning.
No, but I mean, the Supreme Court, the word any, I mean, very expansive, right? And individual, we're still talking about human beings. It doesn't say a limited number, and it doesn't say, you know, by name or zip code or anything.
Well, I think this court in Peer did suggest that there needed to be some specificity.
But,
we did?
But that's my point, that in this phrase you've been discussing with Judge Sintel, why don't we have that same sort of specificity here?
Well, we believe that the burden is on the government to establish the nexus between the harm that they have described and the population that would be impacted.
But all I'm getting at is that if the government's concerned about a bomb at 7th Street, everybody who's at 7th Street at the time the bomb goes off is the harm, the circumscribed harm population, isn't it?
But that presumes that the government has information that there is a particular threat with a geographic boundary. And that doesn't exist here. The government's
relies
on a speculative
projection. The problem with your presentation is that it theoretically it doesn't jive with the purpose of FOIA. And let me just explain. If I take your argument to its end, it means that the greater the harm, then the more likely, the harm to be prevented, the more likely it is that you're entitled to the document.
I don't think that's our argument, Judge.
Well, it is your argument. And the reason it's your argument is that if you had a particular procedure in place, for example, to prevent nuclear attack on the entire United States, you would say, well, that's not good enough because there's no discrete population involved, and therefore you have to turn the document over. So the broader the harm, the more you're entitled to the document. And that seems to me to be exactly the opposite of what FOIA 7F contemplates.
I think because the structure of the FOIA places the burden on the agency to demonstrate the application of the exemption, it's the agency that needs to show that there is that risk of harm to any individual.
Well, that's a non sequitur. The agency has to show that it comes within this exemption. That does not say whether they have to define the population or not. It doesn't follow that they have to meet your standard of what the statute means.
Well, we think there should be some specificity here.
Why?
Certainly,
you seemed to say a moment ago that Peer suggested there had to be some specificity. I don't recall when I signed off on Peer that it had any such requirement in it.
Neither did I.
Nor when Judge Randolph signed off on it. Well, you're putting something in that statute that the court didn't.
Well, we're
in that case that the court didn't.
Judge Santel, we're looking at the opinion. We're looking at the details that were provided in the Fitton Declaration, which were far more extensive than the details provided by Mr. Holzer in this declaration.
That doesn't answer that question.
We're looking
that
at...
That doesn't answer that question.
We're also
Sierra
looking...
Sierra did not suggest that there had to be a specified population. The most Sierra said was that even if there has to be a specified population, there is one here. That's the most well, said in that regard.
Judge Santel, I believe Pierre also turned on your reading and Judge Kavanaugh's reading of Justice Alito's concurrence in Milner. Mm-hmm. And Justice Alito's concurrence in Milner did speak to the 7F issue and pointed also to the fact that there were critical infrastructure documents, blueprints, and maps at issue. And that was also the matter before this court in Pierre. It was the dam vulnerabilities. It was the emergency action plan. It was the maps. These are all specific documents that describe the vulnerabilities that the government was attempting to respond to. We're talking about something very different.
Just
this is
go to the
policy.
Very language of the statute and tell me why any individual in any sense suggests that it applies with greater structure, greater force to a smaller group of individuals than to a larger group of individuals.
We're not arguing that this turns on whether it's a small group or a
yes,
large
you are.
Group. We're arguing as to the specificity of the government's description of the possible harm, which we believe is also what Judge Boasberg was underscoring in his opinion. The government simply failed to establish sufficient specificity. That doesn't go to how large the group could be. It could be the
I
entire
thought I
country.
Read your brief complaining that this could open it up to something that harms the entire population.
Under the government's,
that?
Yes, under the government's
okay.
interpretation.
Right. Now, what's wrong with that? Why doesn't the statute cover 300 million individuals as well as it covers 30 individuals?
Because if we take the B7 analysis requiring only that the government show that the record was compiled for law enforcement purpose and couple it with an unbounded risk of harm to the public, then the government only need assert that there's some risk to the public if any law enforcement purpose-related document is released. It would collapse that exemption into the other exemptions, which is precisely what the court warned about in Milner, because in looking at B2, the court said we should not allow this one exemption, B2, to engulf others. That's the outcome that would be produced. In fact, Judge Santel, you have a couple of opinions, I believe, which point to the scope of 7A in protecting against the disclosure of information that might adversely affect a law enforcement prosecution. Well, the government's argument for this broad reading of 7F reaches, we believe, reaches a similar outcome to several of your opinions concerning 7A, because they are saying, in effect, that one of the reasons that would support their broad interpretation of 7F is to prevent the possible destruction of useful evidence. But that, of course, is the type of concern that you've addressed in the 7A opinions. Now, when we're talking about the Freedom of Information Act, we do believe that the thumb is placed on the side of disclosure, because that is what the court has said, that is the purpose of the statute, and it's not only that it favors public disclosure, but it means specifically that the exemptions must be read narrowly, given a narrow compass, as the court said in Milner. That's all we're asking for.
It does not mean that we can narrow beyond what Congress has narrowed. We cannot change the terms of Congress.
We're not asking you to do that. Now, to the extent that you
then
would...
How would you define any individual to not include the entire population of the United States? In the context of that sentence, it says any individual.
Part of the determination in 7F is the relationship between the affected population and the harm asserted. If the government is simply able to argue that the disclosure of the document could possibly impact any individual in the United States, then that essential nexus requirement, which the court has found in several cases, goes away.
Could reasonably be expected to endanger life or the life or physical safety of any individual. How does that limit it to a defined group of individuals as opposed to any individual?
Well, we think those words have some weight, have some meaning.
Right.
Yeah, they distinguish physical harm to an animal.
Or property.
As opposed to, or property.
Well, the government makes that argument.
Why isn't that good?
The government makes that argument, Judge Randolph, in their brief. We didn't find it very compelling because, of course, that exact same phrase refers to life. So presumably 7F is speaking about individuals. It's not speaking about, you know, property or animals. There's a contemplation that in addition to people, there's some circumscribed population, and even in Pierre, certainly not adopting the Second Circuit language.
I just don't understand. If the threat is a nuclear attack on New York City, I don't know what the population of New York City is, with 8 million, something
like that. Close.
And so in order to satisfy your theory, make sure that what the government does is pick 10 names out of the phone book and puts them in, these are the any individuals. Why does that make any sense?
Well, no one is arguing that people need to be identified by name, and certainly that wasn't the contention in our brief. Or
all right, showing, Queens.
You know.
That's better than New York metropolitan area. Well, it's more specific under your theory.
Yes, I mean, to the extent that the harm could be established, it would satisfy 7F. But also to the extent that you're willing to consider the legislative history of 7F, it's significant that Senator Hatch, when he was the chairman of the Judiciary Committee, seeking to address a concern that law enforcement had raised about the narrow phrase law enforcement personnel, and mm-hmm. recognizing that there are other people associated with an investigation, confidential informants, witnesses, family members, tried to come up with some language to protect the information of those individuals associated with an investigation. That's reflected in this floor statement. That's what he believed he was seeking to accomplish. There was never a hearing on the amendments in 1986. The legislation that had been introduced in the 97th Congress wasn't adopted until the 99th.
You trigger a question that's really not directly on point, but the Second Circuit case was overruled by legislation. Is that correct?
Yes.
What did that legislation say?
I'm not familiar with the legislation, Your Honor. If there are no further questions, thank you.
Thank you. All right, counsel for appellant.
Thank you, Your Honors. It seems like the court has the issues well in hand. Judge Randolph, I might be able to answer your question to my friend about the legislation.
Yes.
My understanding is that it was a specific piece of legislation which said that if the Secretary of Defense made a particular finding about the danger of releasing the photographs that were at issue in that case, that then the photographs would be shielded. So it was a kind
that
of...
was specific case.
It was a case-specific piece of legislation. That's correct. Unless the court has any other questions.
Yeah.
Thank you. Take the case under advisement.